Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by betonline.ag. I am your fearless leader, Todd Furman, and a man who needs no introduction, but we give it to him anyways every time we collaborate on things. The one, the only, Payne Insider. Good to
what
have you
guy.
Back, buddy.
What a guy. I appreciate you introducing me.
I mean, you're the household name around here. I'm the, I like to say, if I have to analogize what we do, I'm the Stockton to your Malone, so I facilitate.
Ooh, listen, and I hate taking jabs this early, but I'm not a big...
Do you want to be Stockton? You want me to be Malone? Is that what you're going with?
Listen, I don't think either of us want to be Malone. The Utah media really portrayed that guy like a nice fellow. On the court, fantastic. Not a good dude off the court.
Well, I wasn't talking about the choices he made off the court. It was more along the lines of what he's
not a huge
on
fan
court,
of deadbeat dad. So don't even. I'm not a Karl Malone guy.
That's a fair point. All right, so we'll have to figure out another point guard.
This is a guy who doesn't.
And,
this is coming from a guy
duo.
Who doesn't really want kids. But yeah, if you have one, don't be a deadbeat.
Thank you for the PSA. A minute into the podcast here on Wednesday morning. Don't be a deadbeat dad. With all of the gambling winnings. Another successful week here for us on the Bet the Board podcast, starting to spoil all you loyal listeners with a double-digit dog that got there outright in the Troy Trojans. An excellent call out of you, Payne. But busy show today, so wanted to go into a couple quick things with you. But there was a major announcement, and you can see it from the Bet the Board Twitter account. Some new swag available for folks to proudly display our brand.
I gotta be honest, I was a little nervous. I'm like, where is he going? I don't know of anything that was new. But yes, new t-shirt is up. The Bet the Board logo tee for 2018 is available. Extremely limited supply. It's a touch darker gray, not as bright, solid print this year. It's actually fantastic. They are flying off the shelves. We sent out one tweet and about half the supply is gone at this point. So get to Bet the Board. What the hell is the website? Bettheboard.net. That works too. Go to the gambling gear section and pick up the shirt. It'll be the first one on the page, top left. And we appreciate you supporting us.
Yeah, always helpful to go out there, and I believe it'll come with a special gift. We won't disclose any of those details, but pick those up before they fly off the shelves. They make an excellent holiday gift. So get it early, get it often. Payne, I wanted to give you about 30 seconds to get things off your chest should you want to rant on Florida State. I know we'll bring it up with Dusty, who called the game, but you know, here's your chance for an open forum to share your thoughts on your beloved Seminoles and the way they've started the Willie
Taggart era. I feel
like
you're setting me up here, as you usually do, but I don't get it. I get that I'm Florida State guy, but I'm just like, overall, I've been down. We talked about this on the podcast preview series. And it was like, listen, this is about a 7-win football team. Obviously, that's not the case. After they lost to Virginia Tech and we reworked our power numbers, we downgraded them. Then the Samford win, that was mostly turnover luck getting to the W column there. We downgraded them again. And after the Samford game, we projected about 4 wins this season. So they were going to miss their bowl game. And then after last week, I mean, I think on the podcast we discussed this. The market and the math guys were going to like Florida State. The X's and O's, the on-field stuff was going to be abysmal, and that's exactly what we saw with their offensive line. It's not fixable. You have interior backup linemen now trying to play tackles. There hasn't been a lot of development in that regard from Jimbo's staff and now the current staff. There was 2 guys that left in the offseason. One was kicked off the team. The other one transferred out. So there's not a lot of talent. They're injured. They're beat up. So this isn't a team that's going to be very good moving forward simply because they can't run the ball and you don't have an offensive line. The offense is not built to be in third and long. This type of offense doesn't matter if it's Willie Taggart running it or somebody else. It's not going to operate efficiently in third and long. So if you can't run on early downs, it's going to be a long season. There's going to be no repair for that offensive line, I don't think. So they're going to miss a bowl game. And right now, I'm looking at this. We have them projected for like 2.8 wins as the season stands right now based on our projections. They're favored this week. It needs to be a win. They won't be favored in another game moving forward after this week.
You mentioned an interesting point. We don't have time to cover it today, but maybe want to bring it back next week about what a market suggests, what the math guys suggest, and what your eyes suggest when you try and find all the different ingredients that go into creating a perfect handicapping formula. So file that away for next week. I may want to try and revisit it in a little greater detail when we kick things off to tease for our audience. But in the meantime, let's get into the games. For all the big game analysis, we welcome in the third member of our talented team here at the Bet the Board podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at Dusty Dvorak, and you can see him not once, but twice this weekend on nationally televised games on ESPN. And Dusty, we will get to both of those games towards the end of the segment, but the floor is yours, my friend, to be as mean as you'd like to Payne, having seen the dumpster fire that is the Florida Seminoles, Florida State Seminoles, up close and personal last Saturday at the Carrier Dome.
Well, Todd, contrary to popular belief, I'm not one to kick a man or a program while they're down, because let me tell you, Florida State is down right now. And, you know, we talked about on the podcast last week, and I don't want to oversimplify things. I think there's more to it than this, but they're so bad on the offensive line. They can't block anyone, and they don't have time to throw the football. They can't run it effectively, and it's really – you know, given this Willie Taggart offense some issues. So, listen, I'm not going to close the door on Willie Taggart after three games, but, you know, we've seen this trend kind of start a few years ago with the poor offensive line play, but it's hit probably all-time lows. And as you sit here at 1-2, I don't want to paint too bleak of a picture, 36 straight bowl appearances, 41 straight years with a winning record. Willie Taggart's got to be feeling the heat right now early on in a place that he grew up loving. But, man, just a really, really rough start for the Florida State Seminoles. Sorry, Payne. It was not pretty. And I'm being kind right now out of respect for you, just so you know.
There's no need to be kind. We're as open and honest here as humanly possible. I mean, I was pretty forthright last week telling you that there was an issue with the offensive line, and it's not going to be fixed. And they needed to win that game to be bowl eligible. One thing that we've done with Florida State and everyone, you know, Homer. This is a team that I said was going to win about seven. We projected for 7.2 wins. So there was no Homer involved coming in. After they lost to Virginia Tech, we dropped them down. They were going to be projected to win about 4.3 games at that point. Right now, they're only going to be favored in their remaining games just once this weekend. That's it, the rest of the season. So, it's ugly. The offensive line is a complete mess, and that was the one reason we liked Syracuse just a little bit last week. It's not going to improve either. The talent just isn't there. There's too many injuries. Last week, you were there for that game. At one point, both starting left tackles were actually backup interior linemen. That's how bleak it is at the tackle position, so we know what Florida State's going to be at this point, and it's probably not going to be solved this year.
Dusty, before we actually get into the big games, you mentioned the heat on Willie Taggart. My friend, it looked like you were the one under a little bit of heat in that sultry Carrier Dome with some of the pictures circulating on social media. Payne was aggressively out there earlier this week trying to find us an antiperspirant sponsor for the podcast.
Let me tell you something, and we will welcome any and all antiperspirant advertisers here on the show. That Carrier Dome, my first time to go in there, explain to me how the Carrier Dome is an air carrier is an air conditioning company, and there's no air conditioning in that place. It was unbelievable. Now, I'm a sweaty mess already, so, you know, like whenever I look at my game and it's this time of year, I see dome and I'm like, perfect, man. Don't have to worry about the heat. Then I find out the night before, my crew's telling me, no, you don't understand. This is a different kind of heat. There's no air conditioning. So, sure enough, it was balmy is an understatement. You guys know when you sit on an airplane, when you have to sit there and wait, and they haven't turned the engine on yet, and you just, like, you're sitting there, and everyone's breathing on one another, and it's stuffy, and it's hot, you just want to be anywhere but there. That's the Carrier Dome for 3.5 hours. It's unbelievable. Now, I will say, we had one of the best perches broadcast booths with where you're sitting, like 30 rows up. I mean, it's unbelievable, but as far as the heat goes, the Florida State players were dropping like flies, and I probably lost about 8 to 10 pounds during that broadcast. But sweat, no sweat, didn't matter. Jonesy and I still got it done.
And it is a cool venue. I've never actually been there for a football game. I was up there for an NCAA tournament years ago, but rest assured, in Central New York, it's not normally 90 degrees when they have basketball or football games going on. Have to imagine the heat gets ratcheted up a little bit for lacrosse. But From an indoor stadium to an outdoor one, where we have a showdown in the Pac-12 North to kick things off on Saturday evening. It's Oregon installed as a 2-point home underdog playing host to the Stanford Cardinal. Total in this game, 57 at betonline.ag. And Dusty, when we look at these two teams, the first thing for me is I see a Stanford side that's been battle-tested. They took on USC. They had their hands full week one with San Diego State. Meanwhile, Oregon on the other side, they've beaten up on the likes of Bowling Green, Portland State, and San Jose State. How do you assess where these two teams are at this early juncture in the season?
Well, you know, ESPN FPI, they've got Oregon as having the easiest non-conference schedule in the FBS, right? So, I mean, they've gotten off to a good start. Cristobal's got to be happy, but they're not battle-tested, to your point. And they're going to ratchet up in competition a huge degree, especially defensively. You know, Justin Herbert, he's been fantastic, 13 touchdowns. And this offense, clearly going back to last year, when he's healthy, it's a different offense. But they're going to take on a Stanford defense that's legit. I mean, they're going to get a huge test in this game. You know, best in college football, giving up just 7.7 points per game. They're turning people over. They're physical up front. So I just, you know, from just a overall matchup standpoint, Oregon hasn't faced anything like what they're going to deal with, the physicality as well as just the overall quality of player they're going to see on Saturday night.
When we look at this game, Payne, Stanford has won the last two meetings in dominant fashion, 49-7 and 52-34. You have to go all the way back to 2014 to find the last time that Oregon actually beat the Cardinal. You've mentioned it before. Stanford plays a different brand of football by West Coast standards. And when you look at this game and see that Oregon has held all three opponents below 3 yards per carry, but sputtered mightily against San Jose State's defense, where do you see some of the matchups that either one of these teams can exploit? And I know you know the head coach at Oregon, or at least have a better read there than most.
You know, listen, I've kind of been hammering this home about Stanford's offense. It's too predictable. It's too archaic. You know, it feels like David Shaw's kind of just pounding his chest with a slab of raw meat hanging out of his mouth while riding a dinosaur. But it seems to work against Oregon because of the style. And, you know, you have an above average quarterback. You have a Heisman candidate in your backfield. I just think you need to be more efficient. And that's the problem that I'm seeing from Stanford offensively right now. 93rd in that regard. We mentioned last season, they were dead last in the Pac-12 in offensive efficiency. They just basically lived on Bryce Love's talent and his explosiveness. All offseason, that's all we heard, right, about this Cardinal offensive line. They were returning seven guys with starting experience, and they had four all Pac-12 honors guys. And right now, what I'm looking at through three games, Stanford's 114th in rushing efficiency, 119th in stuff rate. So that's rushes being stopped at or behind the line of scrimmage. I don't know how that's possible. So I think you need to be a little bit more advanced in what you're calling here. Get Bryce Love in the passing game. Get him on a safety or a linebacker. But I do think the ground and pound will work this week against Oregon simply because they have not played anybody to this point. I want to see also what Oregon is going to do offensively. I know Justin Herbert's the man. We think he's going to be a first-round pick. What's scary to me is Oregon's 47th in offensive efficiency right now. They're not getting explosive plays from their running backs. And they haven't played anybody, right? So that scares me just a touch here when they're going to step up in competition. Two of Herbert's games, he's thrown for less than 47% completions, and that's against horrible competition. So I think that's going to be tough for him this week. It's why we've seen this line move across the zero, and Stanford's now a favorite.
Yeah, it's an injury. Go ahead, Dusty. Jump in there, man.
I was just going to say, and Bryce Love, it sounds like you're about to mention, you know, he missed last week against UC Davis. I'm guessing that was more to get him ready against these Oregon Ducks. I think, you know, Coach Shaw understands the situation. He wants to have Bryce Love at his best in a tough on-the-road conference game that they need to get. And listen, Bryce Love has really killed the Ducks, as you kind of alluded to, Payne. Had a 147 and two tugs in the first half last year before he got nicked up in the second half. So I think having a healthy Bryce Love going on the road, going into Eugene, I think is exactly what the doctor ordered. And I think this, too. You know, one thing about Oregon defensively, they have been good against the run, but at what cost? I mean, loading up just to take away the run. If they try that against Stanford, the one thing I do like is I like that their deep threat, J.J. Arcega-Whiteside. I think K.J. Costello has shown he can stretch a defense. He can make some throws. He's got to be careful with the football. He has had three turnovers in the air. But I think that they've got a little bit more balance this year, And if Oregon tries to overcompensate to take out what will be a fresh Bryce Love, I do think there will be some opportunities down the field.
Some interesting injuries, guys, to keep tabs on. I wanted your thoughts real quick before we move on to an SEC matchup. Starting center Jesse Burkett for Stanford returns. Obviously a key time when you talk about going into hostile territory. And Payne, you mentioned Stanford's inefficiency offensively, so maybe that helps. But they do lose Casey Tuhill. 14 tackles, 2 pass breakups, and 3 quarterback hurries, and 1 sack. Arguably Stanford's best at that position. What do you make of getting your starting center back in this particular spot, Payne?
Oh, it's obviously huge, and that's been the concern for them, is that offensive line, as crazy as that sounds. And I kind of touched on that and what they were looking like from efficiency metrics. So getting him back is certainly going to help. This is a matchup that they've had success with in the back in the past. Mario Cristobal came out this week and he was like, listen, these guys have dudes up front. I am a former offensive lineman. We've recruited some of these guys, so we know them well and how good they are. So when you get your starting center back, obviously that's helpful.
And gone are the days of Chip Kelly. From a point spread perspective, you look at Oregon recently, have not been good to their backers. 9-18 against the spread over their last 27 games, 2-7 against the number as an underdog. In the last 18 times they've taken on conference opponents, a 33% success rate at 6-12 against the spread. But from Autzen Stadium, we head to Neyland Stadium, where a once proud rivalry, a little bit different with new head coaches on the sidelines. And it's the Florida Gators, 4.5-point road favorites at betonline.ag, taking on Tennessee. Total in this game, 47. I don't want to say, Dusty, it's an elimination game in the SEC East, because I think Georgia already has their sights set on winning this division. But what do we make of Tennessee, at least through the first couple of games of the Jeremy Pruitt era?
Well, it's hard to know, right? Against West Virginia, they didn't look very good. Will Greer had a field day against Tennessee, and Tennessee was pretty inept offensively. Now, against UTEP and East Tennessee State, they're 2 wins. Yeah, they look pretty good. But now they're going to play a team in Florida that's going to have, from a personnel perspective, much better players. Here's the deal. Neither one of these teams are playing great football right now. So it may be kind of a really good, ugly game, if you know what I'm saying. But for Tennessee right now, I've got questions about their ability to throw the football down the field. Guarantano is completing over 72% of his passes, but he's not stretching the field, right? He's not really taking many chances down the field. One thing I do like is Ty Chandler back for them. Had a concussion against West Virginia. He's an explosive running back. Had a big day a week ago against UTEP. I think he's going to be a guy who will get more and more integrated into the offense. This is where Tennessee needs to make their hay. For as great as Florida traditionally is defensively, and they're really good on the back end, they have not been good on their front seven. You know, Kentucky ran the football for over 300 yards on them, had quite a bit of success. So if Tennessee is going to win this football game and have some success offensively, it's going to be grinding it out, running the football, 32 minutes time possession this year. That's going to be the recipe if Jeremy Pruitt's going to get a much-needed home victory.
And you look at the Vols' schedule. I mean, I had to do a double take when I looked at this. These are the list of opponents they're going to play all before October 27th after Florida. At Auburn, at Georgia, home against Alabama, at South Carolina. Things clearly don't get easier in the SEC for any of these programs. And Payne, last week when you look at Florida, I don't want to say they got healthy in a hurry in that game against Colorado State, because it looked by all intents and purposes they were able to out-athlete them and just grind them down in the heat. But 48 points, albeit coming on 341 yards. What do you make of Felipe Franks and what he means to the Gators and what Dan Mullen has done over his first couple games in Gainesville?
You mentioned the heat last week, and that's exactly why professional bettors were all over Florida, laid the 19, 19 and a half, even 20. Because that was the hottest game that's been recorded on history at kickoff at Florida. So that was something they did, just wore the boys down from Colorado. Offensively, Felipe Franks is what he is. And it looks like Florida is playing drastically different than Dan Mullen's Mississippi State team did last season. The pace is slow. That's one thing I looked at. 84th in pace. And they're actually just getting off 57 snaps per game. That's 129th in the country. And so to me, that indicates there is an issue somewhere, right? Mullen's attempting to cover up holes somewhere, whether it's his quarterback or, as Dusty mentioned, he doesn't believe his defense is as good as he once thought. But operating that slowly certainly, it just provides this hesitation for me. There's red flags everywhere. They gave up 8 yards per play at home So a pretty one-dimensional Kentucky offense. And you look at some of their explosive play numbers. They gave up an explosive pass to Kentucky on the 3rd and 16. They did it again last week out of the break to Colorado State. So they're not stopping the run. They're having lapses in the back as well. And so, again, operating as slowly as Dan Mullen has, he knows there's glaring issues, whether it be his defense, whether it be Franks, or a combination of the both.
And Tennessee hasn't exactly been great at home of late against the number, 5-11 over their last 16 home games. And Dusty, when we look at these two head coaches, and you hate to say it this early on, but we know the pressure that a lot of the new hires are under early in the season, who is this game more important to? Is this one that Dan Mullen has to win, given the fact that Kentucky ended a lifelong losing streak against them, or Jeremy Pruitt, who's only faced two cupcakes after that season-opening loss to West Virginia?
Listen, both coaches, they need this win, right? I mean, it's a rivalry game. It'll be big for either program. But for me, it's Dan Mullen. There's just higher expectation in Florida right now. I think most people understand it's a rebuild in Tennessee for Jeremy Pruitt, whereas in Florida, they had some pretty good players, and I think the expectation is for Dan Mullen to step in, get better quarterback play, and be able to at least be respectable in year number one in the SEC East. So having, as you referenced, already lost to Kentucky and the first time in forever, if they were going to drop to Tennessee here just a couple of weeks later, that'd be a bad look for Dan Mullen. So I do think this is a spot where I like Florida, but if I'm catching over a field goal, I think this is a close football game. When the Tennessee is going to be able to grind out, keep close. I think Florida just a little bit better, but definitely a hard-fought matchup that both these coaches need. Dan Mullen needs it more. I think he gets the win, but it's going to be close.
Payne, in regards to the number, it kind of sits in no man's land, 5.5 down to 4.5. Any inkling as to where this price may go?
Probably down.
When we look at the Big 12 landscape, guys, there's two teams out there that obviously want to be mentioned in the same breath as Oklahoma. You wouldn't be able to tell by the way they've started this season, at least in my opinion. Those, of course, TCU and Texas. It's TCU, a 3.5-point road favorite for their trip down to Austin. Total in this game, 47.5 at betonline.ag. And recently, gentlemen, this has been a series dominated by the Frogs. They've outscored Texas 153-33 over the last 4 years. 24-7, the score of last year's game, not bad. 31-9 2 years ago. 50-7 back in 2015 and 48-10 in 2014. This, of course, will be the earliest calendar meeting since they became conference rivals. And Dusty, you know these two teams right in your backyard probably better than Payne and I do combined. What have you made out of TCU and Texas through some of the early season thus far?
Well, see, I like TCU, and I thought TCU, they sleptwalked through the first half against SMU, showed up in the second half of a rainy Friday night game, and I don't see how people wouldn't walk away from what we saw Saturday night against Ohio State and be impressed. They stood toe-to-toe with Ohio State. I think most people expected when those two teams stood on the field, there would be a decided difference, right? That Ohio State would have all the dudes, all the athletes, and TCU would be lucky to even stay on the field. They weren't just lucky to stay on the field. They outplayed them for probably about two-thirds of that game. I mean, Ohio State got two defensive touchdowns. We give Nick Bosa credit. We give the athletic defensive tackle credit for being able to get the pick six, but at the same time, just a couple of costly mistakes cost TCU that game that they still, by the way, kept it inside the number, and I thought showed very well. And I look at TCU, and I see a quality football team. Sean Robinson is still growing. He can't turn the football over the way he did a week ago, but you can see the athleticism with the legs. He can throw the football when he's given time. He's a little bit erratic, but if he can get some consistency, I think that they've got a guy who can deliver the ball to weapons outside with Rager and Turpin. And I thought Darius Anderson would have a breakout year coming into the season. He went off a little bit against Ohio State. They showed their ability to run the football, and we know that they can play defense. So I'm pretty bullish on TCU in a spot where, as I read this quote from a Texas defensive back, quote, "I ain't going to lie. I feel like we kind of proved that we're back," Chris Boyd said, "but it's just the beginning." Now, whenever I read that, that tells me Texas is getting high on their own supply down there on the 40 acres, and they're pounding their chest because they beat a bad, and I mean bad, USC team who's got a very similar Florida State disease with an inability to block people. So Texas is feeling good about themselves, whereas TCU really played better probably of the two last week, though in a losing effort, and best believe Gary Patterson will use that to his advantage. I see a TCU team that's going to be hungry, that's going to be hard-fought in practice this week and focused to get back to a winning. whereas Texas feels like they've made it already. They may be taking a week off of practice. I think the mindset heading into this game really favors the Frogs in this matchup.
Payne, how should we look at Sean Robinson? I mean, given the fact this will be his first game on the road outside the Metroplex, I don't count SMU as a true road game. You and I were texting during the course of that Ohio State game and went, wait a second, 3 touchdowns inside of 4 minutes. They did show a little bit of resiliency, and as Dusty alluded to, stayed inside the number. But how do we approach TCU going into hostile territory for the first time with some of the concerns we had with the Frogs coming into the season?
Yeah, that's a great question. Listen, we upgraded TCU off the loss. And as Dusty mentioned, 2 defensive touchdowns. You had a blocked punt. They were the beneficiary of a phantom hold that took 7 off the board after the missed chip shot from the TCU kicker there. And Ohio State still couldn't exceed expectations by covering that number. I thought TCU showed extremely well. The team speed was there. They didn't look outmanned at all. And this is the big thing. Sean Robinson was held to less than 1 yard per rush attempt. He looked competent in the pocket. That Ohio State defense had to respect his arm a little bit. It created more space for Darius Anderson, who, what I'm being told now is, once conference play is in full force, we're going to see a larger snap distribution, a larger usage rate. So for me, it was the Horned Frogs that outgained Ohio State on a yards per play basis. And because of that, we upgraded the number, and I think a lot of people did. And that's why we're looking at opening of 2.5, now out to 3.5. The current number looks about right for me. I don't think I'm going to be tangling in this game, but TCU certainly, even though they are the best team in Texas right now, still likes to pound Texas because of the perception of who best in the state is.
Dusty, Payne mentions perception. I mean, how is Tom Herman being received down there in Austin? I mean, you talked about the fact that, all right, this team feels like they've arrived because they beat up on a USC team that was down, but that doesn't take away from the fact they had to erase a 14-3 deficit early on. I mean, is Tom Herman revered by the Austin community, or is he going to have to go out there and win 10 games this season for them to really buy into what he's trying to sell them?
He was revered when he got the job, right? But it's been a mixed bag since. They've yet to have a 3-game winning streak in Austin since 2014. Let that sink in for a second. So this would go a long ways into, you know, proving, I think, to the Longhorn faithful that this is their guy, because I think that they still think it, but there's a little bit of doubt now, right? When you lose to Maryland the season opener and you mess around to kind of outplay them throughout 4 quarters in Austin in week 2, he had to have that game. And after the slow start, they responded the way that they needed. But this game would go a long way, because you guys have mentioned 4 straight for TCU, 5 of 6. They've owned the state of Texas. And from what I'm told, Gary Patterson, he has no problem sticking it to the Longhorns whenever he gets the opportunity to remind everybody that maybe the Longhorns aren't what's best in Texas. So best believe that if GP has the opportunity, he's going to try to win by as big a number as possible. The one thing going for Texas right now, though, guys, on the positive, is their rush defense has been fantastic. Gary Johnson's a very athletic linebacker. He was all over the field against USC. They held USC to -5 yards rushing. But, again, I just feel like with Darius Anderson, the way TCU's played with a inexperienced offensive line, that's going to ratchet it up. But Sam Ellinger has actually been a positive from the quarterback spot. He gets 2 passing touchdowns. He runs in another one. 2 straight weeks, that's happened for Sam Ellinger. That hasn't happened in Austin since 2008 by a guy named Colt McCoy. Now, I'm not ready to say Sam Ellinger is Colt McCoy, but he didn't turn the ball over, and that's going to be the biggest key here, because TCU's defense is much better than USC's defense, and Gary Patterson is going to try to put Sam Ellinger in some tough spots. Ben Banigou and company are going to be coming on the pass rush. So I think the real question is, can Sam Ellinger prevent himself from the negative play that has really cost his team and himself quite a few victories too early on in his career?
One thing that I found interesting, guys, digging into it, just kind of looking at how TCU has performed against the number, because we always associate Gary Patterson with being good in that regard. And I know ESPN chronicled exactly how dominant they'd been as an underdog. TCU only 7-15 their last 22 against the spread as a favorite, 10-19 against the spread their last 29 games overall. So either playing down to their competition, however you want to spin it, they haven't exactly been great at the window. Back to SEC country, gents, where we see a Georgia team on the road for an early kickoff laying 14 in Columbia against Missouri. This total has been bet up a little bit. Currently at betonline.ag, you're looking at 64.5, the going rate. And Payne, they're saying Memorial Stadium should be sold out for the first time since 2014. It's not exactly one of the more electric home field environments and all of the SEC. We look at Georgia, their overall power profile. They got on the road and they banished any doubt that they might struggle a little bit with a young defense against South Carolina. But for me, this appears to be their first test against a living, breathing NFL caliber quarterback.
This game is fascinating. I think we're going to find out a lot about both. Even if Missouri comes up short, right, we'll get a better idea if we can trust them moving forward. I think there's still question marks on the defensive side of the ball for Mizzou. That was the one thing that I was hoping for improvement on. 82nd in defensive efficiency, and that comes against UT Martin and Wyoming on the schedule. Then they gave up 600 yards through the air a week ago to Purdue, 8.7 yards per play. So I think in this game, the Tigers are going to have to get a critical stop or two each half to have a chance, hold to a field goal if Georgia's down there in the red zone. But you're going to have to keep hanging points. And one thing that I noticed about Georgia, and I'm nitpicking here because they are that damn good, but it looks like that young, inexperienced defense can be had a little bit if Missouri's offense stays patient. And maybe this year with Dooley going at a little bit slower pace, there's going to be a benefit here. Right now, Georgia's 88th in success rate defense. Kirby Smart seems to be playing a little less aggressive early on in the season, kind of negate those mistakes that you mentioned from his young defense. It's worked so far because Georgia hasn't given up the explosive play, and they're stopping people in scoring position, only giving up 2.4 yards per trip inside the scoring zone. But when you're going up against a better offense and a good quarterback like Drew Luck, you're going to have to get pressure on them. And right now, the Bulldog defense isn't doing that. You're talking about 127th in sack rate. And because you have a young secondary and you're not getting pressure, quarterbacks are completing 65% of their passes. That's 105th in the country. So I think if you're Missouri here, you don't want to just chuck and duck these deep bombs. Get the ball out, be efficient, take what you're given, help your defense out by sustaining some drives. And so there's a couple things here that would suggest Missouri's offense can at least hang some points here and not pull an Ole Miss and go scoreless for 59 and a half minutes against an SEC heavyweight at home.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Missouri, pretty impressive, some of these numbers. They've scored 40 or more points in all three games this season. But that streak going all the way back to last year when they were able to turn things around, that's 9 out of their last 10. The only game they weren't able to do so, the bowl contest against Texas. Drew Lock so far this season, 78 of 113 for over 1,000 yards, 11 touchdowns, one interception. He's leaned heavily on Emmanuel Hall, 18 catches for 430 yards. And we do worry about his health and status, something to keep tabs on. But Dusty, when I read a quote like this for an opposing quarterback from Kirby Smart, I don't know if his arm can get any stronger. He can make every throw. He threw the ball outside of the stadium last year on us. I think the biggest thing is his maturity level, his confidence. He's seen the coverages. He's seen the checks. He understands where he wants to go with the ball. He's got as fast a release as anyone I've ever seen. On and on and on with effusive praise. What does that lead you to believe, having been in those meetings all week long, knowing you're going up against an NFL caliber quarterback if you're a member of this Georgia defense?
Sounds like Kirby Smart's doing his best Drew Rosenhaus these days. Is he trying to represent Drew Lock, or is he trying to coach against him? Geez, that's some high praise for Drew Lock. But he's right in a lot of his assessment. I mean, he is a big-time quarterback. He can make all the throws, and he's really gotten, you know, even though Josh Heupel leaves and they bring in a new offensive coordinator, he's just understanding defenses and where to go with the football in a more timely fashion. Much better. But look, Missouri put up 28 points on the Dogs last year, right? In Georgia, between the hedges, that was the second most that they had given up the entire regular season. So we should expect this Missouri offense to have success, because here's the reality. Georgia's just not quite as good defensively. I mean, they're still a good defense under Kirby Smart, don't get me wrong, but they lost a lot of players to the NFL, and guys have not stepped up to this point to fill that void, especially when you talk about rushing the passer. They've only got one sack, guys. Georgia has one sack this year, so to me that's the key to this entire game. Can Missouri protect Drew Lock? If Missouri can protect Drew Lock, and they've done a fantastic job this year, he's only been sacked one time. That's because they got a veteran offensive line, but also because, like Kirby Smart alluded to, he knows where to go with the football. He's a much more mature, confident, poised quarterback in the pocket. If Georgia can't put pressure on Drew Lock, they've got enough outside. You mentioned Emmanuel Moore, an outstanding tight end that can really give a nice option in the middle of the field. If they protect Drew Lock, I expect Missouri's offense to have success. On the flip side, though, I just don't think they've got enough defensively to slow down Georgia. So I'm in full agreement with Payne here, which maybe is a bad thing. But I think that, you know, Jake Fromm's had crazy success. I think Georgia's going to be able to do whatever they want offensively, whether they want to run the football, they want to put in whichever quarterback to throw the football, but they need to kind of play time of possession game, right? They need to be their defense's best friend and allow them to sit over there and rest and wait. And whenever they take the field, they better be ready to come after Drew Lock. I would expect a much more aggressive game plan and trying to come after Kirby Smart, trying to come after Drew Lock and make things a little bit uncomfortable for him in the pocket. If he's got all day to throw the football, he's going to have success down the field.
Dusty, you forgot. It's okay on this podcast to agree with Payne. It's actually a good thing. It's a bad thing when you're on radio in Oklahoma City working alongside our buddy Mark Rogers to agree with him on
his
game breakdown.
That's right.
I know you got a lot of irons in the fire, so I just have to remind you who you're surrounded by at that point. But you guys bring up excellent points. And when you talk about Georgia, I mean, this is a team that's thrived on the road. 6-2 against the number the last 8 times. They've been a road favorite, and this speaks to their mental toughness. 7-3 against the spread their last 10 games on the road. Payne, if Missouri's going to have even a puncher chance, what are they going to have to score in this thing? 35 points?
Ooh, to cover the number, probably. I do. I think they're going to have success because I think they'll be efficient in moving the ball, as Dusty alluded to. Georgia's going to have to play a little differently than they have the first couple of weeks. They're going to have to send pressure because if you let Drew Luck just sit back there and pick apart your young secondary, they're going to have success here for sure. Georgia is going to score plenty. I was a little interested by this total.
Yeah, I'm curious. And there's some weather in the forecast, so anybody who wants to dabble there may want to try and poke around a little bit with the early kickoff to see what kind of impact the weather could have on it. But it should be a fun game to kick things off on Saturday for, as we said, an otherwise dour slate.
I got to throw this out there, Todd. You're ripping a little bit on the crowd potentially at Memorial Stadium. And I just want to take you back to 2002. A young Dusty Dvorak playing for the Oklahoma Sooners went in there. I believe we were top 5 in the country, and we had to get a fake field goal late in the fourth quarter to escape with a victory. So I have been there way back when. Now, 2002, Gary Pinkel was filling that baby up, and as you mentioned, hasn't been full since 2014. When things are going right, which Barry Odom's got a little bit of momentum, I think enough to get the fan base to buy in and to show up for a top 5 matchup against Georgia, it can get lively in there, and it can get a little crazy. So don't belabor the Tiger fans there in Columbia, Missouri, okay? Come on, Dusty, give a little bit of credit.
One question I do have for you, and I'm never sure of the answer, and people are like, oh, you guys probably rehearsed this beforehand. Do you happen to know what the number was when you guys went in there as a top 5 team in 2002? Because I have no idea how big a favorite you guys would have been in that game.
I have no clue. All I remember is Brad Smith. You guys can check the numbers. Brad Smith was a freshman that no one knew about. Everybody knew about him after that game. I want to say he ran for almost 200 yards on what at the time. We had a pretty salty defense at Oklahoma back then. But Brad Smith, he burst onto the college football scene in a breakout performance probably mid-season in Columbia, Missouri, against the Oklahoma Sooners. I don't know what the number was. I can assure you they covered easily. I'm sure we were we had to be. If I was gonna go in and handicap that game from now, I would say you'd have to look at a 14-17 point spread.
That'd been a healthy money line for Brad Smith to announce his arrival on the scene, but a fun dual threat quarterback to watch back in those days, no doubt about it. To the last marquee game we have on our slate for discussion purposes, gentlemen, it's Wisconsin in bounce back mode going into Kinnick Stadium at night. 3-point road favorites at betonline.ag. Total on this game, 43. The road team has actually covered and won 6 out of the last 7 between these two Big Ten West rivals. And it was only a season ago where Iowa gained a robust 66 yards, a little bit flat after their dominating upset of Ohio State the week before. Dusty, I ask you about Wisconsin because I know, Payne, I think you have strong feelings on it. What is wrong with this defense right now? BYU was able to do what they wanted when they wanted running the football. That's not Wisconsin football.
No, you know, they're not playing the other side of the ball. They lost some key pieces off that defense. I thought Jimmy Leonard would just be able to replace the act they have the last couple of years. That hasn't been the case. Squally Canada, he got going a little bit, right? And they let Tanner Mangum throw the football on him whenever he needed to. So, I mean, that was a head-scratcher. I didn't see that. I didn't think BYU was a very legitimate football team. So maybe that should tell us a little bit more about Wisconsin. But, you know, disappointing performance with the talent you have just in your offensive line alone. I mean, you've got 3-4 pros up there up front. We're talking about decently high draft picks, and I think Jonathan Taylor, one of the most explosive running backs in college football. You would think by that alone that enables you to beat BYU. The problem for me, Alex Hornibrook, he has not taken any steps in the right direction. He had a very costly turnover out of the second half. It set BYU up for one of their scores that ultimately Wisconsin could not overcome. I still want to trust that defense just because I think Jim Leonard's an outstanding defensive coordinator, but clearly one thing we've learned early on from a personnel standpoint, they don't have the same dudes on that side that they have in the last couple of years. And if Andrew Van Ginkel, if he's not able to go, that's the Badgers' best pass rusher, and that would be a big loss for them. So I'm kind of sitting here scratching my head a little bit, guys, because I got to tell you, I was high on Wisconsin coming into the season, and I didn't think there was a chance in hell BYU was going to go in there and pull the upset last week.
Payne, you never want to overreact to a team that loses outright as a 23-point favorite at home, the first time in 15 years or so that they lost to a non-conference opponent. But how did that impact Wisconsin's overall power profile?
It impacted it pretty good. I think we were looking at about 6.5 last week, and we've adjusted that down. The question now becomes, how far down do we adjust? That's the biggest thing for me. When I look at Wisconsin, the offense isn't humming right now. But when you just look at the efficiency metrics, the offense has been better than the defense. And I think that's probably where my concern is a little bit. That defense returned just 4 guys. Jim Leonard was always going to have his work cut out for him. Now, they haven't been like a complete sieve, but we're talking about one of college football's elite stopping units with Wisconsin. You look at the last 6 seasons, they finished top 20 in efficiency. The last 3 seasons, all top 7 or better. And when you look at this very moment, they're barely hovering around the top 30. And look at who they've played. Like, it was Western Kentucky, 119th in offensive efficiency. New Mexico, 126th last week. You do take a step up in class with BYU's offense, but they were just 60th. And you lost that game as a 3-touchdown favorite. So we need to see improvement from Wisconsin's defense. And Dusty made mention of this, which was vital. Van Ginkel is a bit banged up this week. Iowa has taken money, I can tell you that, at 3.5, despite the number coming up a little bit short based on the power number. And you do some reading here, and Ferentz has kind of propped this game up a little bit. They consider this the last game of the first half of their season. So like during summer, Ferentz came out and he said his players decided to divide the year into 2 parts, 4 weeks of camp plus the 4 first weeks of the regular season before the bye, and then you had the final 8-week stretch. And players have talked all week about going into the bye on a high note, and that Wisconsin was kind of their midterm exam that they have to pass. You kind of touched on this a little bit with the number, and I know you watched the NIU game more intently than I did, but so far I was 3-0 straight up, 3-0 against the spread. They do have the most efficient defense in the country, but they didn't look great in either of those games. And I know the suspensions played a role in the NIU game, but for large stretches of both those games, NIU and Iowa State looked like the better teams. The Iowa just had great execution down the stretch, which kind of helped them win those games and cover them. Again, mathematically for me, it's difficult to lay points on the road with a total this low in the 40s. But it's like this combination of everything Iowa has working for it. It's revenge. It's the embarrassment from last season. Nate Stanley only averaged 1.7 yards per pass attempt. All the points for Iowa came from a cornerback currently playing in the NFL. And then you get that perception of the Wisconsin loss. The horrors that is Kinnick Stadium at night. And then also, in addition to Van Ginkel, Xander Neuvall, he's the best blocking tight end Wisconsin has. If you look at the rushing success rate metrics, when he doesn't play, they dip dramatically. So all those elements are coming into play here. And despite the number being just a touch short, we have seen professional money on Iowa at this point grabbing the hooks.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you watch Iowa football. They never do anything pretty. They're not going to get the style points. They always seem to get results. And it feels like once every 4 years they rise up and win 10 games, maybe the way the Big Ten West is shaping up, this can be that season. You mentioned Iowa in their first couple games. You beat Northern Illinois. You beat Iowa State. You beat in-state rival. I guess in-state rival in UNI. And you only allow 126 yards rushing. so far. But Dusty, when you've looked at the Hawkeyes this season, I mean, is there anything that's really jumped off the page, or is this just another vintage Kirk Ferentz team that's going to ugly games up? They're going to try and beat you up playing bully ball and hope they can wear you down by the fourth quarter.
No, I think they're legit up front in the front seven. I mean, I think they can really play. They can get after you up front, which is why I just love this matchup. I mean, it's good on good. And, you know, this is a gut check for Paul Chryst and his Wisconsin Badger team. I mean, the strength of Iowa's football team is their front seven. They've completely negated the run. They got 12 sacks, flat out just get after people. Well, what did we talk about earlier? Wisconsin's offensive line, they've been billed as the best in college football for a reason. They got pros up there. I mean, it's going to be old-fashioned, roll your sleeves up, let's get after it in the trenches type of football. And, you know, I just think this is a good spot for Wisconsin, me personally, because I do think that they're going to get maybe have a different sense of focus. They haven't lost a game like this early in the season in a couple years. They've actually, you know, they've been able to navigate their way through the regular season very nicely. So I think that was probably pretty eye-opening last week. And I'm just not fully sold on Iowa. You know, I think that, you know, they've been impressive in so far what they've done, but I know Nate Stanley threw for 300 yards last week. I think that was more about the opponent than that they have a legitimate passing attack. So, to me, this is a game where Wisconsin's defense can have an opportunity to get back on track, but this game's going to be won or lost with one of the marquee matchups in college football on Saturday. It's not to spread it out, throw over the field, big numbers matchup, but it is old school throwback football. Can Wisconsin run the football on that Iowa State, on that Iowa Hawkeye front seven? I think that they're going to have success. If they don't, Iowa's going to yet again come up with a big victory there under the lights at Kinnick Stadium.
A credit to Wisconsin and the brand of football they play. This is a team that's won 9 straight road games, going 8-1 against the spread as road favorites, 10-1 against the spread the last 11 times they've left the confines of Camp Randall Stadium. So, should be a marquee matchup on the slate come Saturday night from Kinnick Stadium. And Dusty, before we let you go, you're pulling double duty this weekend, and you don't have to offer up a pick, but curious to get your take on Temple Tulsa, because some of our loyal, and I'll call them degenerates in a lovable way, will probably want to try and invest here. And Temple, a 7-point favorite at betonline.ag, playing host of the Golden Hurricane. And of course, Clemson, a massive favorite, about 16.5 at betonline.ag, on the road in Atlanta against Georgia Tech. Wanted to get your thoughts on both of those games, knowing that you've studied the film extensively.
Yeah, you know, I think I appreciate the plug, by the way. So I'll be up in the booth tomorrow night with Dan Orlovsky, Dave Fleming, Laura Rutledge on the sidelines for Temple of Tulsa. I think there may be some value to be had in Tulsa here. You know, watching that Temple Maryland game, it was an impressive win and one Jeff Collins had to have, because they got off to a terrible start, losing to Villanova, losing to Buffalo. And obviously Maryland with the win over Texas, that was very eye-opening for them to be able to come away and get that win. But, you know, they hit a fake punt for a touchdown. The ball kind of bounced their way. They still don't have great quarterback play. Their defense stepped up and played much better. But offensively, you know, they're lacking some real dynamic playmakers. And, you know, when you look at Tulsa, that was a bad loss for them against Arkansas State, because they really did go down to Austin week number two and give them all they wanted and some. They lose by 7, but they missed 3 field goals. Also had a fourth and short inside the 20 they didn't convert on. So they really put themselves in a good position down there and showed well against the Longhorns. I just think that with them losing to Arkansas State and with Temple winning a nice win against Maryland, I think that you're seeing a little bit – I think there's some value to be had on Tulsa, because I think it's going to be a very hard-fought, extremely close match that both these teams are going to want to get a conference victory. So take that for what you will. I think it's going to be a close game, and if that thing ticks up over a touchdown, I think there could be some real value to be had. And then let's go to Saturday. I will be leaving from beautiful Philadelphia on a flight to Atlanta on Friday morning to walk right into the offices of Paul Johnson, as we'll have Georgia Tech hosting Clemson. That's a 3:30 East Coast kick on ABC national TV, boys. We're stepping up.
Dusty, one thing before you get into that breakdown, just let us know ahead of time if Paul Johnson's already started to box up his office after this slow start.
Come on, man. You can't be killing Paul like that. I got to go sit down with the man on Friday. I'm sure Coach Johnson is doing just fine. You know, here's the thing. It's such a tough matchup for Georgia Tech, right? Because, you know, we know about Clemson and their front seven. And breaking down that Texas A&M game, my biggest takeaway from that Texas A&M game, Kellen Mond made some plays in that game, fellas. I mean, he really stepped up And he made a name for himself for me watching the tape, extending plays, trusting his receivers, and just putting the ball where it needed to be. Now, Clemson's front seven, they're still as good as advertised. Cleveland Farrell has just been a man-child up front so far. I don't think that's changing. Georgia Tech's inability to throw the football down the field makes them so one-dimensional with Taquan Marshall. I just think it's going to be tough to imagine them being able to put up the kind of offense they're going to need to. But Georgia Tech is much better at home. I think that they've lost they had lost seven straight on the road, whereas they've won 9 of 10 back at home. They have beaten Clemson. They're at Bobby Dodd 5 of the last 6 times they've played. So, you know, Clemson in its own right, they kind of struggled a little bit last week. They didn't look great. It's interesting because when I watch the tape, this offense functions much, much better, more efficient, more explosive with Trevor Lawrence and Kelly Bryant, yet we continue to see them rotate each quarterback. So I'm hoping for a close game, but Georgia Tech's going to need a turnover, a big play in special teams, or be able to hit a play-action pass down the field if they're going to keep this thing competitive and interesting throughout.
Busy weekend for Dusty, a busy weekend for our listeners as well. Dusty, safe travels, my friend, and we'll chat with you same time next week, hopefully with a few more intriguing matchups on the schedule for us.
Absolutely, boys. Enjoy the college football. Happy betting. And again, if you get an opportunity, Thursday, Saturday, we'd love to. I won't see you, but we'd love it if you saw us.
Busy weekend for our friend Dusty, not calling one but two college football games, and was interested paying to get his take on some of the marquee matches. But man, what a slate in terms of, I don't even know if you get excited about it as a fan, but the marquee games we talked about, there don't appear to be a whole lot of betting angles worth a damn either.
There is not a lot of oomph in this card, whether it comes from the big matchups. Now, there is value on the board, certainly, and I think we'll be able to pinpoint a few spots. But the games we discussed don't love a ton of those angles. The Iowa game is interesting. I want to see where that first half opens up. That one will be interesting to me. But not a ton of value on the games we discussed. We will have a best bet, obviously, at the end of the podcast. Hopefully we can continue to get betters to the window there. But other than that, it's kind of a slow week. And one thing that we teach, every week doesn't need to be a home run. Throughout the course of the season, you're going to have weeks that you absolutely love. You're going to have more action in play. You're going to have larger bet sizes. And then that's part of being a gambler, being able to identify where your spots are. And then there's some weeks where you're just going to want to get through. You're just going to want to hit singles. Breaking even is fine. Get to a part of the season where you really like and there's opportunity.
Hey, Tony Gwynn got to Cooperstown and he didn't have home run totals like Barry Bonds. So there are a number of ways to skin a cat, especially in the gambling business. So it's always good to hear you reiterate it. But one last thing before we get to Dave Mason. Of the five games that we talked about, not from a gambling perspective, as a college football fan, which one intrigues you the most this weekend?
It's going to shock you. And I think I've signed a contract on not discussing Pac-12 football.
I was going to say, oh my God, this is a watershed moment. Mark it down. Bet the board history. I think it's finally going to happen.
Yeah, it's Stanford, Oregon. I want to see what these two teams are. That's the biggest thing. And I think Stanford's a little more battle-tested. Oregon hasn't been tested at all. I want to see what Cristobal can do offensively. There's certainly some scares in that regard because I don't love what the offense has done. Justin Herbert's got 4 interceptions at this point, and he's played dog crap defenses. So that scares me a little bit. And I want to see if Stanford can take that next step, if they're going to kind of move forward and be a contender and not so much a pretender. Now they do play in the Pac-12, so they're going to have ample opportunity to beat up on some teams and look good. But this is a tough place to play. Let's see what Stanford has as well.
From the big game breakdowns and a handicapping angle to the sportsbook perspective. He joins us every Wednesday to talk about college football from the sportsbook perspective. You can follow him on Twitter at Dave Mason BOL. He, of course, is Dave Mason. And Dave, last weekend, college football, good or bad weekend for, well, in our case, the good guys, but for a lot of our listeners, the house being the bad guys.
Right. Now it's a good weekend. Good weekend college football again. It's been a good start to the season. No complaints. We're probably overdue for a big losing weekend, so I'm waiting for that. Maybe you'll hear me whining and bitching next week, but we'll see. No whining and bitching this week. It was a good week. The house, we won big on SDSU. Boise State under, that was our second biggest win. Iowa State, and the players profited off of Alabama again. Georgia, as usual, and Memphis.
Dave, before Payne jumps in and asks you about some of the money you're seeing this week, I want to ask about that total. Is it rare? I mean, that's got to be rare for you guys to have one of your biggest decisions on an over-under, especially in college football, no?
No, no, you're exactly right. You know, I really don't mention them that often, if at all, on this podcast when I'm talking about our biggest winners and losers. But that one was massive, so that was definitely – and, you know, it didn't seem like Saturday. It was like the week before. I didn't think we were really winning. I was looking at the needs early on, and as the day went on, I didn't think we really had a lot of big wins. I think we just grinded out a good profit, but I think the bigger decisions went to the players. It's just there were so many more of the mediocre games that went to the house, and I think that's how maybe the total snuck up there and got in the top three wins for the house.
That's really interesting, I got to tell you. And when we look at this week, there's not a ton of marquee matchups like we've had in previous weeks. Professional bettors certainly don't care where their money comes from. Have we seen any sharp action thus far?
Mucho sharp action, Payne. Mucho. Marshall plus 6.5. That's currently 5.5. Indiana plus 5.5. That's currently 4.5. Stanford plus 1.5. They're minus 2. Buffalo minus 3.5. They're up to minus 5. West Virginia minus 14. They're currently minus 16. Auburn minus 25. That's all the way up to 30. Iowa plus 4. They're down to plus 3. And ODU plus 28. That's down to plus 27.5.
And what sides are racking up liability from the public side?
Oh, boy. We got a lot. They're fading. They're fading FSU for some weird reason. 79% of the bettors are
on Northern.
you could sense the sarcasm there. 79% on Northern Illinois, 80% on Ohio State as usual, 82% on Clemson as usual, 70% on Stanford, 86% on Auburn. Big one, 89% on TCU. That's getting the most bets. And it's very lopsided, and 87% on Georgia at Mizzou. That's also getting a ton of bets. So looks like those are going to be our two biggest sweats of the bet.
Dave, real quick for you, when you talk about a weekend, and we broke down what I guess I can loosely call, Payne, the marquee matchups for the weekend on a pretty unattractive slate. I'm going to guess from the house perspective, it's not ideal when the money is spread out. You guys probably prefer, the biggest programs playing in the primetime slots, or do you like it better when the game day is broken out a little bit like it is this weekend?
No, what you said before, the primetime games and the big slots, gets the most action. Sure, we open ourselves open for a bigger loss, but also a bigger win. You're going to win more over the long haul, win more money, so... We just want as much action coming in as possible, so the marquee matchups are, really get more players coming back, react. Some guys might go dormant for a week or two, and, if there's a big can't-miss game, a must-bet game, they're going to come back and bet that game. So you always have to look at it from that perspective as well, just getting more players back, more players signing up, and more excitement going on. If we lose, no big deal. Let's do it again Sunday or next week or whatever, but just get those players interested in coming back.
One man's garbage is another man's gold. And you mentioned sign-ups. For those players looking to try and get involved with betonline.ag or maybe looking to reload their account this weekend for either college or professional football, what kind of promotions are available at the shop?
Yes, sir. If you do not have a betonline.ag account, get on over to betonline.ag and sign up for one. Use promo code 75BTB for a one-time 75% welcome bonus. If you already have a betonline.ag account but not have taken advantage of the Bet the Board Reload bonus yet, use promo code 50BTB for a one-time 50% bonus for the sportsbook. The max bonus is $1,000. All the terms and conditions can be found at promotions.betonline.ag/bettheboard.
That's Dave Mason. You can hear him here with us on the Bet the Board podcast every Wednesday to talk about all things college football. He also joins us on Thursday for the National Football League. Encourage all of you, our loyal listeners, to follow Dave on Twitter at Dave Mason BOL. Dave, thanks as always for your time today and best of luck this weekend in the college football ranks.
All right, fellas. Talk to you soon.
Absolutely fascinating stuff from Dave Payne. When you mention the big boys, obviously they're going to need to try and avoid Ohio State, Clemson, Stanford, Auburn, TCU all taking money. But hysterical when you think Northern Illinois is a 10-point dog, one of the trendier plays on the big board this weekend as well.
Ugh, my poor Knowles. This is what life has become. The one interesting thing there, not to rehash on Stanford, Oregon, is let's see how high this line gets at some point. even though I'm not in love with Oregon, there should be resistance once you start getting around that key number as a home dog. But that will be something that you'll want to monitor. For me, I'm on the sidelines at that point in this game.
I'm interested to see where that total goes. I still, in the back of my head, and I meant to get it out when we previewed the game, think that Oregon has held back exactly what this offense is going to look like. But still, you don't love what you saw to Justin Herbert, 16-34 against San Jose State. So much like you, I know you said it earlier, fascinated to try and watch that game because it'll give us some clarity on the Pac-12 North. But
maybe a little Gundy action. Gundy, to his credit, held a lot back in the first few games for Oklahoma State, and he kind of emptied the playbook against Boise last week.
Taylor Cornelius on the read option over and over and rinse and repeat for all the bad things we say about Gundy. He was playing chess. Brian Harsin was playing checkers in that Oklahoma State-Boise matchup. So we've gone off the grid each of the last couple weeks identifying live underdogs, and they've been more than live, winning outright, catching double-digit points. Payne, which game or games may have really caught your eye for this upcoming weekend?
Let's go with a nice little home dog here. 330, North Carolina plus the points. There is four out there, obviously. Get that if you can. It likely is trending towards 3.5. I think that number's fine too, but you really want to get the best of the number. Try to get 4. But we like North Carolina here. I think the spot, the situation's very good. First home game, it's a look-ahead game. It should be a letdown spot. You know, UNC has been pretty embarrassed so far this season, and you do a lot of reading, and it feels like this game might be bigger than the game itself with Hurricane Florence rolling into the Carolinas. Just kind of, they want to play a good game, show out here, give the people of Carolina maybe 3-4 hours to remove themselves mentally from the devastation that's gone on there with the flooding. So this feels like it could be bigger than the game itself.
Yeah, sometimes the human element trumps some of the X's and O's on the field. We saw that take hold, and we profited from it from Carolina. It looked a little bit disjointed in the professional ranks. Hopefully, North Carolina use it as a galvanizing effort. And I think when you look at their opponent here, Pittsburgh, an emotional game against Penn State 2 weeks ago where they were drubbed, bounced back and played one of the best first halves we may have seen under the Narduzzi era. But once that emotion subsided, you saw Georgia Tech start to get back into the game. If North Carolina brings it, I'm not sure Pittsburgh will be able to match their intensity. So North Carolina, a live home underdog this coming weekend in Chapel Hill. Special thanks to Dusty Dvoracek, who joins us every week during the college football season. You, of course, can follow him on Twitter at Dusty Dvoracek. Dave Mason, who joins us not once, but twice every week on Wednesdays and Thursdays to talk all things college and professional football. You can follow him on Twitter at Dave Mason, B-O-L. You can follow Payne at Payne Insider. You can follow the podcast at Bet the Board. You can follow me at Todd Furman. Go to the website, pick up your swag, buy those t-shirts. They'll be gone before you know it. Payne, I'm going to give you last word. Any parting shots?
No, let's get out of here.
All right, buddy. Best of luck to all of our loyal listeners again this weekend. Hopefully, middle of Saturday afternoon, we'll see you at the window.